So here we are. It's a very grand setting. I wasn't sure whether I was supposed to read a poem or ascend into the sky sitting on this rather grand chair. Anyway, never mind. It used to be a bigger room, didn't it? When I came here thinking, I'm sure it was bigger, and it was bigger. Yeah, I was right. Okay, so I'm going to start this seminar. It feels a bit odd. I didn't mean it quite in this spirit. That's why I brought my tea, just a chat, really. Anyway, here we go. So I always have to wind into it a bit, so I'll tell you a story first. So when I was a young man, I was a nurse. I trained as a nurse in Coventry in England. And I wasn't a very good nurse. I was quite good with people, but I wasn't very good at other things. It's the other things, actually, that are rather important, like, you know, how many tablets you give them and all that. I was quite good with people. I used to work at night sometimes, and it was about the time they were showing E.T., do you remember? And I used to walk around and I used to shine my pen torch through my finger and go, ouch! Ye good, things like that, which the patients used to like very much, but I'm not sure it helped them. And then one day, we had an elderly man came in, and he, can't remember his name. I can't quite remember what he looked like. He was almost unconscious when he came in, and it was very evident soon that he was dying. As I said, I didn't know him. I can't remember his name. Can't remember what he did. I had no experience of him. I never spoke to him. But you know, it was evident he was dying. I just trained to be a nurse, so I wanted to sit with him whilst he was dying. They quite quickly decided that there was going to be no treatment. So I asked to sit with him. And, of course, the sister wasn't very keen on me sitting with people because it used up staff. And understandably, it meant we were always very busy. We never had enough staff. It was the sort of thing you were supposed to do, but rarely you did it because of staffing and so on. So sitting with the dying seemed a luxury. Anyway, I was a young man and I insisted against my superiors. And I sat with him for a while and he suddenly woke up. He hadn't been awake at all before then. He suddenly woke up and he turned to me and looked me very, very deeply in the eyes. And of course one never can quite really say what people's eyes said, but it felt to me absolutely clear what he said. He looked, he opened his eyes suddenly and looked at me, and in that look, seemed to communicate, oh no, I'm just about to die. It's like he'd suddenly woken up to the fact he was about to die. He was at that moment about to die, and in that same moment of realization that he was just about to die, he seemed to communicate a realization that he'd never lived. This terrible sense of, but I haven't started yet, I haven't lived yet, I can't be dying now because I haven't lived yet, life hasn't taken place yet. It can't be true that I'm dying now. I haven't started. And then he burst into tears and then died. And that, in a way, I then went back to my work. But somehow, that meeting has had a huge effect on me in my life. I thought that for the first time I'd seen, perhaps not quite for the first time, but nearly the same first time, I'd seen the truth. I'd seen the truth, that a realization of death, and in that realization, the realization that one hasn't lived, that one hasn't started yet. Yeah. And I think it's out of that kind of realization that spiritual life arises. I increasingly don't think much of this idea of a spiritual life. I don't like it. Recently I went on this panel where there were spiritual people from all over the shop. There was a Christian minister, there was a Hindu teacher, myself and another teacher from Enlightenment Unlimited or Enlightenment UK, I can't remember. And we all talked about things. And I really thought it was really rather unhealthy. I just thought, what are all these people interested in the spiritual for? It was as if it was a subject, something that you might be interested in or not. Like some people are into motor cars, and some people into hill walking, and some people are into spiritual life. You know what I mean? People even say to myself, well, I want to now look at my spiritual side, or I feel a very spiritual person. Please don't say you feel a spiritual person to me, because you will not get anywhere. I will frown upon you. I never know what it means, and it always sounds a bit like it means I'm a special person, in a way that actually I'm a hill walker doesn't. I'd rather people say they're a hill walker or a plumber. I think that what we rather clumsily call spiritual life is to do with the facts of life. Actually, the word spiritual is a translation from the Brahma of life. That's where it comes from. The Brahma life, Brahma is a god. It's not in the Western theistic sense, but he's a god, he's the highest god. So a Brahma life means the highest life, in a way. The best life, the highest life, the greatest life. Yeah. Which is much better, isn't it, than spiritual life, which is strangely abstract, strangely anodyne, tasteless. But I think if we were to think of spiritual life at all, it would be better to think that human life is a spiritual life, whether you like it or not. And frankly, I don't much like it. but human life is a spiritual life. There isn't something you can decide to do which is a spiritual life. You've already got one, whether you like it or not. Spiritual life is thrust upon human beings, very often against their will. And our aim, the purpose of life is to answer the call of our life, is it to mean? So I say that because human life is unfathomable in so many ways. It's a koan in so many ways. So, for instance, it always strikes me that it's a koan about who you are. We didn't choose to come into this life. We didn't design ourselves. We didn't come up with a personality we rather liked. We didn't come up with a kind of attitude to life that we thought was a valuable one. We were given all that. We came into life with all kinds of attitudes, beliefs, thoughts, temperaments that we didn't create. Not only, they say, don't they, that half of our personality is genetic, is genetically loaded. So half of us is somebody else. when you think of it. So when you say me, you mean half of me, you mean somebody else. And lots of those people you don't know and have never met. Of course, a lot of them to do with your parents, but half of you is somebody else. I mean, one of the things that they've been doing is doing studies on twins. Because one of the things they tried to do many years ago was find out how successful therapy was. Because, you know, so many people were in therapy, so many people were saying how valuable it was. Actually, the research they did do found very, very little at all, shockingly so. And the research they did do wasn't cross-referenced with genetics. So when they started to look at things like identical twins, you suddenly start how to find the genetic loading. So there's a famous case of the giggle twins who tend to get, they're called the giggle twins because they giggle in the middle of a sentence. they start talking and they start giggling. They both had the same kind of job, they both had two children. They had the habit of doing that when they spoke, pushing their nose up with the back of their hand, and they both liked to drink black coffee. None of which would be surprising until the fact that they met each other when they were 45. They'd never met each other before. So even things like turns of phrase, things like a taste in black coffee, which is very cold black coffee, by the way, which is very unusual, they had in common. When they met, 45 years after their birth, they were both wearing almost identical clothes. So when you start to look at that, you start to realise how much of what we think is me is other people. I mean, I remember on one tree I coughed and I thought, oh, that's exactly my father's cough. It's exactly the same sound as my father's cough. Presumably I've got the same shape of throat as my father. And the same big ears, unfortunately. So that's part of the mystery to our life, isn't it? Is that we're half somebody else. We're half somebody else. And then to add to that, we don't know who that is. We don't know who we are. We come into life, we just appear in life with a personality, with all kinds of genetically encoded temperamental things, turns of phrase, attitudes to life. For instance, it's even genetically much more likely that you will be alcoholic if your parents are alcoholic. It's not just to do with learned behaviour. It also seems to, a behaviour seems to affect genetics. And this is one of the things that, so I've heard being discussed, that not only is genetics affects behaviour, but they think that behaviour affects genetics, modifies genetics. And you then have to discover all that. You don't know who you are, and you have to discover it, and you have to discover how you work. And that's often a rather difficult process. There's no manual to you. There's no clear-cut guide to how you should live. Yeah? So that's a very odd thing. We're born into life with a pre-existing set of characteristics which we don't know and which we have to discover, and then we have to discover how they best work in life. Meanwhile, we're reacting to the very people that we're actually rather like. Sometimes you just get over all that just by the time you're 35 or something, by which time a lot of the game is over. But of course the great issue in our life is that the one thing that we least want to happen to us is going to happen to us, and we don't know when. Human life could hardly be more problematic. If you were to find an alien and say to them, well, the thing about human beings is that there's one thing above all things that they do not want to happen, and that will certainly happen, and of all the things that will certainly happen, this is the one thing that you don't know when it will happen, aliens would say, well, that is a huge problem you've got. You have now got a great metaphysical problem. And that's what we've got, isn't it? We're going to die, which is the thing we least want to happen. The thing that we least want to happen, we don't know when will happen. You could hardly imagine a more problematic birthright, if you know what I mean. We're born into a person we don't know, into a life that will end, we don't know when. So it's those facts that make life a spiritual life. You don't need to think of anything separate from that. You don't need to think, am I interested in a spiritual life? You see what I mean? In comparison with that, being interested in a spiritual life is really very trivial. It's a very trivial matter. It is a bit like being interested in the occult, or interested in crystals or something. It might be fair enough, but it's really rather trivial, given the fact that you're going to die and you don't know when. So human life is a spiritual life, and the only question really to us is, do we engage with it or not? That's it. The reason you've come on this retreat, the reason that I've come on this retreat, is because we sort of want to engage with that issue. And we only sort of, don't we? Give me a cinnamon bun and I seem to be willing to put that issue aside. Or a good film or whatever, I seem to be willing only too easily to put that issue aside. But we sort of want to engage with it. For me, I don't want to be that person who opens their eyes and in that moment realises they're going to die, and in that moment feels they've never lived, that they haven't started yet. I don't want to be that person, and yet a lot of my behaviour is like that person. I'm not so very different. I would suggest that none of us are, really. But it's that that makes our life a spiritual life. So when we're thinking of a spiritual life, when we're thinking about Buddhism, we're thinking of that kind of issue. We're not thinking about anything technical. We're not thinking about anything Eastern or indeed Western. We're not thinking of an ism like Marxism or consumerism. We're thinking of the primary issue of life, which is the fact of death, the fact that death casts a shadow over our whole life, even though there's pleasure, even though there's happiness in life and fulfillment in life, there is always death there, and we don't know where it is even. It's as if we're in a landscape and there is death in this landscape around us, but we don't know where it is. It could be under the bed, it could be right over there just behind that wood. We don't know where it is, but it's here somewhere. And it's always here in our life. It's that fact that makes our life spiritual. Without that fact, there wouldn't be a spiritual life. So we need to get away, I think, from any kind of technicalism, any kind of idea that Buddhism is a sort of very technical thing that needs to apply to people that you could be into. And I think it's better to think in terms of a journey and a guide. So that's why I've called my book The Journey and the Guide. Human life is a journey in itself, isn't it? From birth to death. Nobody knows how long that journey will be. And spiritual life, what we call spiritual life, is a journey from where we are now to enlightenment. And enlightenment is the solution to birth and death. I like to think that human beings are born with a great problem, capital G, capital N. No, capital P. Quite easy to spell in English, never mind Swedish. A great problem. And that enlightenment is a great solution. What do you mean? It's like that. It's as simple as that. You've already got the great problem. The question is whether you want to commit yourself, whether I want to commit myself to the great solution. And between those two things is a journey. And that journey needs a guide. And the guide, par excellence, is the Buddha. He's the first person to have travelled the whole journey on his own, without any help. So if we want to follow that journey between the great problem and the great solution, we need to follow the one person that first travelled it, whose travelling of that journey was most pure, in a way, most archetypal, most legendary, most complete. I really like this lovely Zen way of putting it. It's a bit like guiding somebody home from the pub. Zen way of putting things is so often much more concrete, less abstract, less grand sounding, which I think is very, very good. So if you imagine somebody being drunk, they just come out of the pub, and they need a friend to guide them home. Otherwise, they'll get into all sorts of trouble. Not only that, they're walking along a little thin path, and on the right is one great descent into the sea, and on to the left is another descent into brambles and so on. So this drunken person is wandering down this muddy path, and they need a friend, a guide, that says, "No, no, no, go to the left, go to the left, go to the left. No, no, to the right, to the right." And you see how it would be confusing. You just think, "But you've just said to the left." He said, "Yes, but now go to the right." So you go to the right. They said, "No, no, no, to the left." He said, "But you've just said to the..." You see what I mean? The guide is in that relationship to us. So he keeps on saying, "Go to the left." But then he'll say, "No, no, no, go to the right. No, 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 go to the left." He's the one that sees the danger we're in. We're just drunk. You know what I mean? We need someone to sort of guide us home. Yeah? So I think that's a much better picture of what spiritual life consists in. And when you embark on that journey from the great problem to the great solution, that drunken journey on that slippery path, and we are drunk, aren't we, because we're drunk on the idea that we're not going to die. That's what we're primarily drunk on, is that we're intoxicated with this life of ours. We went to a little museum on the way here, and I don't know whether you find that. I'm often touched by those photographs that they put up of people sitting and looking at the camera, children sitting on the floor, fathers, mothers. There's one with clearly one of them is a father and a little girl, and she's sort of how children do, standing next to her father's knee and sort of finding sort of support in that. She's about the age of my niece, she's a little bit older, 6 or 7, that way that children cling to their parents. And when they're tired, particularly, they go to their mother or the father, they don't go to their friends anymore. And this picture of them like that. And then, but all of them have died. Every person in the photograph have died. The little girl died long ago. And, you know, the poignancy about these pictures is you don't know who they are. You don't know their names. You don't know anything about them. But we think, yes, but I'm not like that. We're intoxicated with this life of ours. And we think that I'm not like that. I'm not like that little girl pressing against her father's knee. I'm me. Things don't happen to me like that. The great study of this, I think, is Tolstoy's short story, The Death of Ivan Illovich, which is a wonderful account of someone dying. It's a great novella. He wrote it when he was quite young, but you know, it's spookily accurate. I'd very much recommend it. So we're intoxicated with life, we're intoxicated with youth, we're intoxicated with our health. We can't help but think that this thing goes on forever, even though we're surrounded by evidence that it doesn't. Yeah. So when we follow that journey, that intoxicated journey on that slippery path, we go through 5 great stages. Again, whether we like it or not, whether we know it or not, whether we quite do it in that order or not, we have to pass through 5 great stages. These 5 stages aren't they aren't a theory. They aren't somebody coming up with 5 handy things. They're, I think, Pante describing having practiced spiritual life for many years and having really immersed himself in the Buddha's life for so many years. He's describing what that journey inevitably looks like. You know what I mean? And those 5 great stages are the stage of integration, the stage of positive emotion or kusala karma, the stage of spiritual death, the stage of spiritual rebirth, and the stage of spontaneous compassionate activity, or sometimes called the stage of no more effort, which always sounds nice. The stage of no more effort or no more learning sometimes. Bhante's got these from various sources, these 5 great stages, but I think they become effectively his own kind of vision, really. And as I said, we need the guide. So the guide, if we look at the life story of the Buddha, we can see those 5 stages. So we all know the story of the Buddha going out from the palace and seeing the 3 sights, first of all. Does everyone not know that story, just in case? Don't take it for granted. He goes out, doesn't he? He lives in this palace. According to... people say legend. I don't like the word legend. Sounds like it's not true. By legend, I mean according to the sort of archetypal legend of the story. In other words, the deep truth of the story. Whether it's historical truth is neither here nor there. Actually, the more I've written about the Buddha's life story, which I've never done before, all the legendary aspects, so-called legendary aspects, the so-called magical aspects, the metaphors, they seem to me, if you think about them deeply, they seem to be actually more accurate, in my own experience, than the other aspects of the story. They seem more truthful. they have the truth of great poetry or the truth of art, rather than the sort of diary of history. But according to that story, he was living in a palace with his father. His mother had died when he was in childbirth. And according to the story, the father had this feeling that he was told that his son would either grow up as a great ruler, like himself, or a great sage. The king, his father, wanted to stop him becoming a great sage, so he created a pleasure palace where anything painful was cast out, anything ugly, anything that would make you think, in other words, was cast out. Very, very interesting metaphor, that the pleasure palace. I think we've created that in modern Europe. We've effectively created a pleasure palace in which the pain of life is very much kept out. So I've been writing my book on my laptop computer. It's an iPad, iMac, iBook, whatever it's called. It's not an iPad. Anyway, never mind. It's an Apple computer. And of course we know, don't we, that the people who make them are having to work in such awful conditions that they throw themselves off the factory roof, and the people, the Apple, have put nets around the walls to stop people killing themselves because it was causing such bad press. So that's the world we've created. We've created a palace where I can do my online shopping, where I can look at little clips on YouTube of comedy programs from when I was a child. And the people making those computers are in such awful, degraded conditions that they regularly try and throw themselves off the top of the factory. So there's a sort of almost historical sense to this pleasure palace. But we human beings try to create for ourselves a place, don't we, where everything's all right. We try and do that, I think, on the macro level and the micro level. Like, I'm really struck by how much I want something nice to happen. I don't know whether you have this, but somewhere I always wanted something nice to happen. So I always want to go to a cafe on the way here, which indeed we did, and it's very good. And when we go out to an exhibition, I want to have a cinnamon bun. And, you know, I've been writing poems, so I want to win a competition, or I want to get my poem published. And it's always disappointing, isn't it, if you don't get those things. If you don't win the competition, you don't get published. If you don't get a cinnamon bun. We try and make a world in which nice things happen, and which we try and make a pleasure palace. And that pleasure palace that we try and build kind of keeps us a bit asleep. We're sort of, it's pleasurable, but it's not very meaningful. We sort of know that, but we try to disguise it from ourselves by more pleasure. And the world we're living in now has now become incredibly adept at giving us pleasure if we feel uncomfortable. So, a few weeks ago, I bought a book while sitting on a train. First time I'd ever done it. It said, "Do you want to look at the stall?" I thought, well, there's no reason why not. So I looked at the stall. "Do you want to read an excerpt of this book?" Well, no reason why not. So I just pressed my thumb, read the excerpt, and of course I then bought the book. And I bought it just by flexing my thumb. I mean, that is a incredible place to get to. They think very soon that you'll be able to buy a bottle of wine just by, they'll have mobiles that can read barcodes. So your mobile will just be able to read the barcode, and you'll be able to just put your mobile across the, just shine it across the wine, and then you bought the wine. Very soon when you're watching television, if you like Paul McCartney's jacket in a film that you see, you'll be able to stop it and buy it online. You'll just be able to click onto it in jacket and you just buy it. So we're in a world, we've created a world, we really have created a pleasure palace, haven't we, where all you need to do is just very slightly flex your thumb, and a bottle of wine, a book, a Russian lover can be already downloaded to you. Anytime you feel a bit uncomfortable, anytime you feel a bit uneasy, you can have something. You don't need to be at home. You can be anywhere, can't you? And this is the world of the known. But Siddhartha leaves that world behind. It's very striking in the legend that he goes out in a chariot and he goes outside. Of course, this may just mean that he realised it, and it's a story way of putting a realisation. You know, because what happens is he asks his charioteer, takes him outside, and the charioteer takes him and he sees, first of all, an old man. Yeah? And he says to the charioteer, "What's that?" He's never seen an old man before because his father's kept all of those out of the palace. Suddenly sees it's an old man, really realises what that means, really sees it. That's what it means for me, that's what it means for all of us. Yeah? But he really sees that, not just with his head, but with his whole being. You see what I mean? So that might be a wonderfully story way of saying he suddenly realised that he would grow old. But the metaphor, I think, takes you further, because it shows that to see that you grow old, to genuinely see it, you need to leave behind your habitual mindset. I think of the palace as representing our habitual mindset, our habitual way of seeing the world, our instinctive human complacency. To see that you're going to get old, you have to leave that behind. And interestingly, what takes him out is that the charioteer's name is Chanda, or Chandaka, depending which language, and that means he is who is interested. So the metaphor there is you need to arouse your interest. You need to get your interested. You need to get interested in the fact that you're going to get old. You know what I mean? That's what the metaphor of the story is saying. And it's that interest that takes you out of yourself. If your interest isn't taking out of yourself, it's taking you into yourself. The more it takes you into the self, the more you're prey to self-absorption, and the more you'll become depressed. Our great human gift is that we can be interested, and that interest can take us out of ourselves, can take us actually to the nature of reality. So Siddhartha sees an old man, really sees what that means. He then, as we know, goes back. He then goes out again. He still sees an ill person. He really sees that. Seeing is knowing for Siddhartha, so he sees and knows that he will be ill himself, and that all beings will become ill. And then, of course, finally, he goes and sees a dead person. He sees that he will die. And he sees it all the way through himself, if you see what I mean. He doesn't just assent to it. Actually, we see these things all the time, but we don't see them. Do you remember when you were a teenager, and there's no teenagers here, but when you're a teenager, you just don't see older people at all. They, if you see them at all, it's because they're in your way, and they're like boring, you know what I mean? And they insist you like come home from, you know, I'm sorry, oh, no, you know, they're so boring. I remember my nieces doing that when her father was talking, and she was a teenager, like that, behind his back. Recently, my little niece, she's about her fourth birthday. I said, "Oh, can I come to your birthday party?" And she said, "No, I'm only having children." And I said, "Well, I'd like to come to your birthday party." And I was carrying her at the time. She looked at me and she said, "Think, what do adults actually do?" You know, you could see her and think, what would be the point of having you at my birthday? And it was obviously quite a problem for her. I was carrying her at the time. And she was looking and thinking, well, what would be... And then she looked at me and then eventually thought, ah. And she said to me, okay, well, we do need some adults because they can sing happy birthday. And if someone gets upset, they walk across and say, ask what's the matter. And you could see her thinking, well, that about exhausts it as far as I can see. That is all that human beings do, adults do, you know. They don't play, they're no fun. All they do is they sing happy birthday, and then if someone gets upset, they're the one who walks over and says, what's the matter? You know. She really had no conception of what other use they could possibly have. It's a wonderful sort of little story. It's so true, isn't it? That you just don't see that actually they provide your very life. You don't see any of that. You just think, well, they're no fun. So you see that, again, spiritual life is a maturing of ordinary human life. It's not anything different. Just as Alex will gradually realise that, oh, actually, her parents are the ones that cook food for her and make, you know, do everything else for her. hopefully eventually she'll get to the point of actually feeling grateful for that, and eventually see, gosh, there's quite a lot in that. Do you know what I mean? But that's a growing up. She can't see it now. She has a vague sense of adults being tall people who insist that she has a bath, and that, you know, for no obvious good reason. You know? It's just like torturers, basically. You know? Insist that you do things you don't want to do, you know. Come up with spurious rules about how many books you can read, or, you know. So you can see that our spiritual life is really just growing up more and more, so that we actually see, but remember that you do grow old, and you grow sick, and you die. I mean, right at the end of the Buddha's life, you get Ananda weeping, don't you? That famous story, going off and weeping that the Buddha was dying. And when the Buddha asks, the Buddha suddenly is dying and thinks, hang on, where's Ananda? He's been with me all this time, he's not here, where is he? I can't, he's incredible tax, and I can't go into Parinirvana without Ananda here. So he asks and calls for him, and Ananda's brought back. And the Buddha doesn't sort of regale him with the nature of reality, doesn't talk about his spiritual life or metaphysics. He just says, but Ananda, have I not told you this will happen? Have I not been pointing this out to you all this time, that you will people grow old and they get ill and they die? Have I not said that to you? And would that not happen to me? I mean, it's right at the end there of his life, it's not a metaphysical teaching. He's just saying, but did you not remember? Did you not grow up? Did you not see this? That's what I've seen. So this spiritual life is just an extension, not just, but is growing up, is human growing up. It's our great journey of growing up. And our choice is whether we want to grow up or not. But Siddhartha saw the great sights, three great sights. And what's of course different between him and us is that he saw them completely. He saw them in a way that utterly transformed his life. He was never the same again. It's interesting when you think about this, because actually that suggests that the Buddha's life starts with wisdom, actually, effectively. But he saw, did he gain enlightenment then? Do you mean what actually happened then? He actually saw the facts of life as they actually are, and because of that changed his life. You only know if you've seen the facts of life if you change your life. If you don't change your life, you haven't seen them. You just thought about them. One of the things that I'm more and more struck with, and I'm sure I'll come back to in the seminar, is how we so easily mistake ideas for experiences. We so easily think that because we know something and can say something and can give rousing talks about something and write books about something, that we've actually know it. We're so saturated in language that we really think it's reality. We forget it's just ideas. I mean, very, very difficult to live out the spiritual life in life, not in ideas. I think it's actually very rare. It's very easy to live out in ideas, and it's easy to look quite impressive in that way. But they're just ideas. They're just ideas. And ideas, well, they don't get you very far. So what you've got in Siddhartha is someone who sees completely. And the only way you can see like that is to be integrated. We mean to see it, don't we? We're not bad people, human beings. We mean to see it. I mean to see it. Somewhere, part of me, half the time. I mean to see the facts of life. And I even try to, even when people very close to me die. A few years ago, a very good friend of mine died that I was ordained. I tried to see it, but, you know, before I knew it, I had forgotten it. Not quite forgotten it, but half forgotten it. We're in this weird place, aren't we? We know we're going to die and we don't know. It's very strange. It would be very difficult to describe to an alien our relationship to death. Nobody would say, oh, no, I didn't know you were going to die. No, that was a complete surprise to me. We all know it, and yet we don't know it. It's really very odd when you think of it. Nobody seriously says they don't know. Even a little child knows. So again, with my little niece Alex, when she was very, very young, she said, "Mata Banda, do you have a daddy?" And I said, "No, I don't know." She said, "Is he dead, Mata Banda?" And I didn't even know she had that word then. She was very, very small. And I said, "Yes, he is." And she said, "What happens when you die?" So I said, "Well, nobody really knows. But I think it's quite possible there's a great white light and you go into that and everything's different off that." And she said, "Yes, but what happens before that?" As if that was perfectly straightforward. As if, yeah, well, we all know that, but what happened before that? And I said, you say sorry to people you've hurt and you thank people who've given to you. Well, you know, life happens before that. So it was very struck me that she didn't know that you die. She said to me, "Even children die, but I'm nearly four." As if she'd gone through the dangerous age and had survived to being nearly four, so things are going to be fine. So we do sort of know it, and yet we don't. Yeah? The only way to know it is to be integrated. There is, you see what I mean? This is what I mean by this isn't an option. The only way to really know the facts of life, old age, suffering and death, is to be integrated so that when you see them, you know it. You're not just seeing with a small part of your cerebral cortex. You're not seeing with an aspect of yourself, the part of yourself even that wants to be spiritual. You're actually seeing it. Like you're driving a car and you see a tree and you swerve to avoid it. You know what I mean? You actually see it. You know what it means. You know if you carry on, you will die. You know. The only way to see like that, so that you swerve to avoid the crash, as it were, is if you really know what it means, and that means you need to be integrated. There's no way around that. So integration firstly means that your thought needs to be integrated with your emotions. Sangharakshita famously says that you need to find emotional equivalence to your intellectual understanding. To be able to think needs to be the same as to being able to feel. And that means thinking more deeply and feeling more wisely. It means having our thought deepen, which is what we're trying to do just now, and have our emotions be uplifted, be enlivened, uplifted, enriched, sensitized, educated. It's as if we need to stop being clever so that we can be deep, and we need to sort of educate our heart. We need to do both those things. We need to eschew pseudo-cleverness, which is just a way of avoiding genuine thought, and we need to educate our emotions so that our emotions are our thoughts and our thoughts are our emotions. That is the first great task, so that when you're nursing your mother or whoever it is that's dying, you see it. You see what this means. You see it as an inevitable fact of life which changes your life. Until then, you're not integrated enough. So we need to keep on working at integration. So that's the first great stage of spiritual life. By definition, you need to be integrated, without which there's no seeing. There's just an idea, really. So the primary practice of integration is mindfulness of breathing, as I've said this morning. What that means is constantly collecting yourself, doesn't it? All that you're doing in mindfulness of breathing is you're stepping away from propunctia, from proliferating thought, into direct experience, so that your thought flourishes out of direct experience rather than just bobbed on the top of it. You see what I mean? So often our thought is just from mid-air, isn't it? I've got a section in my book that I call mid-air thinking, where we're not thinking, we're just thinking from other thoughts we've had or from other thoughts other people have had. We're not thinking about our experience. We're not thinking into our experience. We're not trying to fathom the odd sheer weirdness of experience. we're just sort of thinking in midair. You see what I mean? So we need to be thinking from our experience, into our experience, about our experience, rather than just cooking up a theory in midair. Yeah? So that our thinking faculty is integrated with our body and with our emotions. This is the first great task, without which no means exist. Yeah? I'll just say one or two more aspects about integration and we'll see if there's any questions and move on to positive emotion. I'm trying to cover quite a lot in this time. One aspect I've come to think of integration, the primary aspect of integration, the reason why it's so spiritually important, is because we need to see the facts of life. We need to see our real situation. And only integration will do that. The rest of seeing is not really seeing, it's just tick boxing? Box ticking. Tick boxing is a kind of sport. A bit like kickboxing, but you do it with ticks. I hope everyone's following my very odd English. It seems to get worse when I'm abroad. But yeah, so that's the primary thing. We need to be present to our experience. So when the real things happen, we know what it means. And there's only the real things happening. Already, in this very moment, there is a rising and ceasing. So is this seminar arising or is it ceasing? When did it start to arise? Did it arise however many minutes ago? Or did it arise when Virabodhi Fast wrote to me and asked me? Did it arise then? Or did it arise when I agreed to do it? When did it arise? And that's just for me. When did it arise to you? Did it arise when you came on the retreat? When you turned up today? When you thought about coming? But whatever this seminar is, it's arising. And at the same time, it's ceasing. And when did it start to cease? Did it start to cease when I started the talk today? Does it cease at the end of the third seminar? Or did it cease the moment I thought I'd do it? Did it cease the moment you booked on coming on the retreat? When did it start to cease? Do you see what I mean? So what we have is always, at the same moment, arising and ceasing. And we want, if we like it, we tend to grasp to the rising aspect of it. Oh, a cinnamon bun is arising. Or a seminar arising, or a retreat is arising. If we don't like it, we'll grasp the ceasing aspect of it. So if you want me to stop talking, you'll start to grasp to the ceasing aspect of the seminar. If you're finding the retreat uncomfortable, you'll start to look forward to the end. If you're having a really good retreat, you'll start to want to push the end away. Do you see what I mean? But actually arising and ceasing are always here now. The day is arising and ceasing. When does evening start? Did it start when the sun rose, or is it, so forth? So, we need to be integrated so that what happens to us is happening to a person who's fully aware, collected, present to experience, and someone for whom thinking and feeling are the same activity. Intuition and thinking are the same activity. There's just one person all the time, as it were. But some kind of other sort of more subsidiary things that I think we need to think of in terms of integration. We can think, for instance, of, are we different people for different people? When you have a birthday party, do you get nervous about bringing together all the different people in your life? And is that because that you're a slightly different person for different people? Because usually when you have a slightly different ethics for different people. So not only are you one person with one person and another with another, but you're a different kind of ethical person with one. So you might be leery and sweary. I don't know whether you'll understand those words. Or you might swear and shout in with your pub friends and be over earnest with your Buddhist friends. But you'll be slightly different people. Are you a different person publicly to you are privately? Are you different at home than you are outside of the home? Sometimes people are very generous and charitable outside the home and a tyrant at home, if you know what I mean. So all of those issues are issues of integration. Yes, are you a different person in public to in private? But also I think another issue of integration is this question of fathoming yourself. Are you... do you know yourself yet? How do you function? What kind of creature are you? We're like strange starfish, and we need to sort of work out what kind of starfish we are. And part of that is just integration. It's not morally loaded, but if you don't learn to manage it, you'll get tripped up on it. Like, are you an introvert or an extrovert? How much time do you need with others? How much time do you need alone? What kind of emotional setting do you have? Do you have a quite high emotional setting? Quite a low, cool emotional setting? What kind of creature are you? That will be built into who you are. How do you make that work? How do you work at your best? How do you flourish most? If you don't work that out, you'll bump against yourself, you know what I mean? And you'll try and or you'll try and change things that perhaps can't even be changed. They're part of the structure of the mind. Bhante said it's not so much the structure of the mind that changes, but the contents of the mind. So I think that's all part of integration. Getting to know yourself in that sort of way. What kind of being are you? And then learning how that being flourishes. So for a while, for instance, I was doing a job at the LBC, which I was oddly unsuited for. I was the director of the centre and the director of our health and well-being aspect of the work. And for some really odd... I mean, it wasn't that difficult work, but I was really unsuited to it. What it did seem to do, it seemed to provoke my tendency to worry, and it provoked my tendency to feel averse, to feel aversive, to feel critical. And it did it very, very strongly. So much so that I became really very unhappy, but couldn't understand why it was, because it's no really big deal, this doing this work, it wasn't that busy. But it was somehow just really deeply didn't suit my being, if you know what I mean. I'm not very good in meetings, I can do them, but I don't flourish in them. Whereas some of my friends find teaching very nerve-wracking. I've never found it nerve-wracking. I get a bit nervous, but I've never found it worrying. And actually, I tend to experience myself flourishing in these conditions, rather than, you know, getting sort of aversive to it. So what kind of work best help you flourish? What conditions do you need to be in to make the most of your life? If you've got a drink problem, you know you can't afford to hang out in a pub. You just can't afford to do that. Other people can, but you can't. If you easily distract yourself with social media, which I think is becoming a major issue, just the time we dribble away on the computer. Us human beings seem to be living from one screen to another now, don't we? When we're tired of one screen, we think, oh, I need a break. What shall I do? I'll watch a DVD. You know, we go to another screen, or the same screen with a different portal. The computer's become a portal to everything, hasn't it? If you're that kind of person, you need to be careful of living alone, for instance, because you're very likely just to get more and more sucked into that. We need to be very, very objective about what kind of built-in flaws there are to our being that stop us living well, that stop us travelling on the journey. We need to be very, very careful of that and actually do things, set about, create conditions in which the best is brought out of us. I mean, that's really what a retreat is. We're trying to create conditions in which the best can be brought out of us. Relationship with nature, a sense of community, an easy sense of friendship, living together, having time to meditate, having time to think about the great issues of life. they're the conditions that bring the best out of us. Yeah? So we need to do whatever we can to create conditions in which the best is brought out of us, not the worst. Because the worst can be brought out of us, and it can be very humiliating. So that's the first great stage of spiritual life. I said a lot more about it in the book, but it's at the stage of integration. Especially so that we're one person, so we're, our intuition, our emotions, our intellect are all one faculty, which later on I want to talk in terms of imagination, because I think that's the word most suited to that unified faculty of reason, intuition and thought is imagination. That's what imagination really is. It's the fusing of those usually separate aspects of the psyche. And that we're integrated so that whatever happens to us is happening to the whole of us, so that we completely learn the lesson that life is trying to teach us, which is always teaching us, every moment. Any questions about that before we move on? And then I'll say a bit about positive emotion and then we'll leave it at that. But any questions about that so far?
Do you really consider them as stages, or more like a spiral?
Ah, yes.
Happening simultaneously.
Yes, yes, that's a very good question. So I think you can think about them in two ways: either as a journey, which is what I'm mainly going to be doing in these seminars, mainly because it's easier actually. Because with the metaphor of a journey, you can say do this and then do that, and then as you do that, this might happen. The way to avoid that is this. You know what I mean? It suits a story, doesn't it, a journey? It's a temporal metaphor. It's to do with time. So this happens, then this. So that's one of the primary metaphors of Buddhism, is a path, a journey. This happens, then this. You start here, you end up there. Yeah? But it's only a metaphor. And then the other way you can think of it is as a mandala. A mandala... it's supposed to be the ground plan of a temple with the most important thing in the centre. I like to think of it as a kind of abstracted, open flower. That's how it seems to me, with the stamen in the centre and the petals all around it. So in that metaphor, there's no hierarchy apart from the central point, interestingly. In a journey, there's a clear hierarchy. You do this and this. To get there, you have to do this. This is not that. We're not as far on the path as that, you know what I mean? It's time creates hierarchy, in a sense. The mandala means that all of those five elements need to be there all the time, and there's no one that's more important than the other. Of course, the important thing is the central thing, which I think must just be the Buddha, you know what I mean? The mystery of the Buddha. I don't think that any of the petals... there's one that's more important than the other. So from that point of view, from the point of view of the mandala, we need to practice all five stages all the time. And it's a spatial metaphor. It opens in space. And all metaphors are either spatial or temporal. Actually, life doesn't conform with either of them. But we can only think in temporal or spatial metaphors. So when you think of a lotus growing out of the mud, we think of it growing in terms of time, but then it opens, and we can't help but think of that in terms of space. But the lotus is unimaginable in the stem, isn't it? It's not really that the stem, actually experientially, it's not that the stem leads to the flower. If you'd never seen a flower before, and you just saw the stem growing up, it would be unimaginable, that flower. You know what I mean? It's not literally this happens, then this. So it's the relationship of us is like the stem to the Buddha, like the stem to a flower, like us to the Buddha. We have in us that unimaginable blossoming, if you see what I mean. So you could never say quite that this happens and then that. You know what I mean? So life doesn't conform to either metaphor. Both have got their values. It's easier to talk in terms of time. And probably I think the metaphor of the journey or the path is the primary metaphor. Because, and I think that because you need to get going. Whatever else happens, you need to get going. I think that Buddhism is very explicit about this. It wants to say, never mind all that, you're going to die for heaven's sake. That's a really dangerous position you're in. They say it's a bit like suddenly discovering your turban's on fire. You're in a burning house, your turban's on fire. That metaphor is not trying to talk metaphysically about impermanence, which is much more difficult. It's just trying to say, get a move on. Do something. You know what I mean? That's what the Buddha would start with saying. He wouldn't say, yes, there's five things, and yes, we need to be receptive, and da da da. You just say, never mind, get a move on. Do something, act. Yeah? So I think the journey is primary, and the mandala only comes in to correct the misunderstandings inherent in a journey. The primary one of which, I think, is that it gets too future-orientated. So you start thinking, it's always jam tomorrow, in the English phrase. That it's always, the goodies are going to happen tomorrow. Difficulty today, but goodies tomorrow, if you see what I mean. So your life continually moves away from you, you see what I mean. There's always a sale on tomorrow. And then tomorrow, there's a sale on tomorrow. Yeah. So there are inbuilt problems with the idea of a journey, and to deal with those problems, you have to bring in the mandala. But first, you've got to get going. You've got to meditate, you need to be practice ethics, you need to go on retreat, you need to get going. Then you can correct that later on.
You said the body is the source to all integration?
Yeah.
Can you say something more about that?
Yes, I'm glad you asked, because I'm, as usual, I'm yet to think this completely through. I think too much can be made of the body and too little can be made of the body. Probably that's true of everything. Too much can be made of thought, too little can be made of thought. Sometimes people talk about thought as if it's actually a bad thing. People say you're in your head, as if your head doesn't belong to your body. Actually, I'd much rather lose a limb than a head, I can tell you. You know what I mean? But people are sometimes mock thought as if thought is a bad thing. I think it's to do with a problem of language. In English, we've just got thought. In Sanskrit, you've got prapunkcha. Now, prapunkcha in Buddhism is always conceived of as a negative thing. So one of the epithets of the Buddha is nisprapunkcha, no prapunkcha. So the Buddha has no prapunkcha. He doesn't mentally proliferate. But he can think and does think. What you see in the Buddha is someone who thinks very, very deeply indeed. He doesn't proliferate. He doesn't think, gosh, this is going on for a long time. Will there be time for tea before the meditation? I need a bit of a snooze. Oh, God, you know, will it be like this every time? And you know, he doesn't do that. If he's uncomfortable, there's just discomfort. And then he thinks, I must try quietly draw him aside afterwards. You know what I mean? He doesn't propunctuate. He doesn't get into that ruminative, problem-solving thinking. But he thinks very, very deeply. Quite clearly, the Buddha thought very deeply. He wasn't a metaphysician. He's not a theorist. But he thinks very deeply. To think very deeply is a physical thing as much as it is a mental and emotional thing. I love this Greek idea of the gymnasium. Originally, in the gymnasium, you not only worked your body, but you also worked your mind and your... So you'd write poetry, you'd do karate, you'd do wrestling, you know, you'd do the whole thing. I think really that's what we need to be creating more and more, is a whole thing. So in one moment we need to be singing, another moment we need to be trying to look at the best of Titian, read the best of Shakespeare, read Thomas Transroma. On another hand, we need to be thinking very deeply. On another hand, we need to be doing regular exercise. We need a gymnasium in the Greek sense. That's really much closer to a Buddhist vision of spiritual life, which is different from a head trip on one sense. But I've also seen people end up thinking about the body as being, I don't know, somehow, like people say your body's always right. It's clearly not always right. Any Alexander teacher will tell you that, that you can think that you're in a good posture and you're not. What do you mean? Your body can be just as wrong as your mind. There's nothing privileged about your body. But to think deeply, you need to think physically. Your mind needs to be more embodied. So you need to keep coming back from this tendency to a propuncture. That not only deepens your body, but deepens your mind. When my meditations go deeper, it's not just my body that goes deeper, but I think more deeply. This morning in the meditation, I seemed to think it was as if a bird came to roost in my heart. As soon as I had that thought, I could, as it were, feel the Vedana of the heart much more, because the metaphor of a bird inside my heart and the wings touching my heart from the inside was a different metaphor from me trying to see it from above it. Does it mean? So if I thought of a bird entering my heart, what would my heart feel like to the wings of a bird? Suddenly I could feel those Vedanas more. So the tendency in modern life to separate the body from the mind is a weird Western thing, if you see what I mean. For most of us, we need to, I think, emphasize body much more without turning the body into religion, which I do sometimes see, and I sometimes even see in so-called Buddhist circles, which I don't actually think is very healthy. It feels indulgent to me, and that can't be the journey. Long answer, but actually I'm glad you asked, because I've actually managed to think about that. I've been meaning to think about that for ages. Part of the problem comes from the fact that we Westerners have split everything up. So we think of a body and a mind and emotions and intuition. But hey folks, it isn't split up. We've never actually had a body and a mind and an intuition and an emotion. We've never had those things. We've had them together all the time. They've never been split up. It's just that mentally we can split them up. We can talk about emotions, we can talk about thoughts, we can talk about the body. And then we start to think our categories actually mean something. So then you start to think, hang on, what's the relationship between body and thoughts? But do you see what I mean? We've created the problem by thinking that the categories actually exist. There's never been a body without thought, and there's never been thought without a body. No one's had it. It's just we've thought about it, and we've mistaken those thoughts for experience. Do you see how deep it goes? Why don't we play more? Yes, I think play is very important. Children play, don't they? Most of the time, mostly what children do is play. It's really rather irritating when you have to get them to read. I feel a bit sorry for my niece. Every time I have to try and get her to read, and she clearly doesn't want to. She quite likes looking at the pictures, but she doesn't want to read. I can't help feeling that we're putting far too much emphasis on reading, on literacy, as if the only thing that human beings do is think and talk and write. I'd much rather have play, actually, and make things, and I think it'd be much healthier. But of course I can't do that, because, you know, we're now in this whole system where, before she knows, she'll be taking an exam. You know. Oh, good. So I think we do need to play. The question is how do adults play? Probably for most adults, sex is how they play. I'm not advocating it. We won't be doing it on this retreat. It's not that kind of retreat. And anyway, but probably that's partly what it's about. But I think my own theory is that that's what the arts are. They're adult play. And we need to cultivate an adult play. Not because we're trying to be arty people, for heaven's sake. We've already tried to get away from being spiritual people. Let's not then crash into being arty people. Oh, no. But because we need to play. And I think when you really get into a work of art, whether it's a poem, a piece of music, whatever it is, you experience this kind of play. And actually, they're created from play. I mean, it's famous about Mozart, isn't he? That he would just sit at the piano and improvise, that's right, and just watch himself improvise this whole thing that would just come out from three notes. It'd just be dum-dum. Then he'd think, oh, you could do it. Then you could do that. Then you could... And he did it until eventually he'd have this kind of ecstasy, and he used to gamble around the furniture. He suddenly just couldn't bear it anymore and would jump up and gamble. You know what I mean? It's like divine playfulness. And actually, if you listen to Mozart deeply, that's what you mostly experience. You don't quite know what he feels, actually. I never do. But what you have is this incredible ultra play. His music is like snow crystals. They're all perfectly formed, all forming out of each other. Without anybody doing it seems to me at its best. And they're just sort of perfect. So I think the arts are play. I think also, on a sort of different level, we need to laugh and play in that sense. One of the important things about having friends is people that you can play with in the right way. Laughing is very important for human beings. You need to be able to have a laugh. If you can't have a laugh, your spiritual life is going to go a bit wonky. One of the dangers of spiritual people is they get over earnest. I once joined a poetry group discussing poems, and I sat at this table. I'd never done much outside the movement at all, in groups. And I was suddenly in this group again, like I often am. We were sitting around a table, and I looked around and thought, oh no, another load of earnest faces. Everybody totally earnestly looking at me. I thought, oh no, I don't want any more of this. I've had it. So you definitely need to have a laugh. You need to be able to do that. If you don't do that, you get a little bit out of shape, I think. I think it's one of the issues of taking responsibility. If you're not careful, you start to take more and more responsibility, and I think a spiritual life must involve that. I'll come to that later on. There's no spiritual life without taking more and more responsibility. But if you're not careful, you take it all too seriously and you stop being able to play. I think that is an essential part of the journey, is being able to play. I mean, you actually do sort of see it even in the Pali Canon. There's clearly the times but the Buddha is having a joke.
And playing is simple.
It's simple, yeah. The thing is, you can't do it too willfully, because if you're doing it too much, it's not playing. Children don't think, right, I'm going to play now because it's good for me. They just play. So we need to find a way of playing that is play, not trying to play. The trouble is, with the arts, you need to make a bit of effort so you can play. I'm reading again Thomas Tranströmer, in English, of course. It's actually very, very easy to read, but not all poets are, and you need to make a bit of an effort before you can get their play, if you see me. At best, you're trying to play with them. And at best, their work is a kind of play, a serious play, a play that's about life, a play that takes you away from life and yet enhances life. Very, very odd that human beings can do it. So you can read The Death of Ivan Illovich, which is about the fundamental issues of life, and feel you've learnt very deep lessons from it, and at the same time be playing. That's the value of the arts, is that they're serious play, if you see what I mean. At best, if they are the arts. Yeah. So let me just say a little bit about positive emotion, because it's given me 5 minutes, and then I might talk a bit about it tomorrow, and then we'll go on. But, what do I want to say about positive emotion? No, I don't, I think. So I'll just round up. I think that might be enough for today. So, what I've talked about today is that there is no such thing as a spiritual life that we choose. There is only a spiritual life we have, and our question is whether we engage with the spiritual life we have. And modern life is designed in such a way as to help you not engage with the spiritual life you've already got. It sort of stops you, even. It means that you only have to start to feel a bit uncomfortable and you can buy something or download something. So there are many ways not to engage with the spiritual life that you have until the moment of death. Then suddenly, in that moment, you realise what you've been doing. They say, don't they, when you die, your life flashes before you. And I think that must be true, but not in the sense of the details of your life, but what have you really been doing? What have you really been mean to doing? Apart from what you say you've been doing, and what you'd like to have been doing. What have you really been doing? Have you been trying to answer the question of your life? Have you been trying to turn towards a great problem of life? Or have you not? Have you had an idea about it? When I watched this man die, that's what he seemed to wake up to, is waking up to the fact of death, and then waking up to the fact that he had not lived with that fact. And because he had not lived with that fact, he had not lived. He had distracted himself. He had not been there. That was my sense. He had not been there. So much of our life, we're not here, are we? Just not here. So let me just finish with the fourth great sight. Because, of course, when I was talking of the guide, the Buddha, I was talking of the three sights. But, of course, there are four. Without the fourth sight, there's no Buddhism. With the first three sights, all you have is a nihilism. All you have is a kind of acceptance of old age, sickness and death. But in the fourth sight, it's only that when you get to the fourth sight that Buddhism arises. And what the fourth sight is, it's not a vision of God. Neither is it, so it's not a theism. Neither is it a belief in science. He doesn't think, oh yes, I'm going to die, but my molecules will go on and live in a stars. Or, you know, the molecules that make up me came from stars, and they'll carry on and they'll become part of the universe. So in a sense, he doesn't see that either. What he sees, so he goes beyond this awful binary between religion and science, which is increasingly entrenched and increasingly dogmatic. You now have dogmatic science and dogmatic religion. There's a very interesting book called The Ten Dogmas of Science that I was watching a little film about Rupert Sheldrake talking about, and he was saying that dogmatic science is now stopping experimental science experiment. So we now have dogmatic science and dogmatic religion. What Siddhartha saw was the wandering holy man. That's how it's pictured in the story. And story is a better way of saying, so what he sees for a glimpse is someone who's gone forth, is usually what it said. I like to think what he sees for a moment is a glimpse of the great solution. A glimpse that there is a solution. Not a false solution, not a pretend solution, but a genuine solution to the facts of life. That's what he sees in the holy man, is a solution, the possibility of a solution, a glimpse of reality. It must be a glimpse of perfect vision that he sees. He sees that there is a way from suffering beyond suffering. Yeah? And in that seeing arises the whole of the spiritual life, and in that seeing arises the second great stage, which is positive emotion.